If your company is struggling to manage your RFI process, listen to this episode of Digital Builder and learn how to fix it. All right, welcome to another episode of Autodesk Digital Builder Podcast. I am your host, Eric Thomas. Today, I am joined by Sid Haxar, the Senior Director and Head of Strategy and Industry Partnerships here with Autodesk. And today, we're going to be talking about the dreaded RFI process or request for information out in the construction world. Also talking about the common pain points in today's workflows with RFIs and how we might solve them. So Sid, welcome back to the show. This is, I think, your second appearance. How are you doing today?
Thanks, Eric. Great to be here. And I guess I must have done something right to deserve another invite back. So yeah, appreciate it being here with you.
Yeah, it's good to see you again. And I think Jim is still the reigning champ as far as the number of appearances, but we'll keep bringing you back as long as we keep having these great conversations. I'm excited to hear your thoughts about RFIs. I know you've got a really cool narrative that you've been talking about tied to the end of RFIs. And so I'm looking forward to unpacking, you know, what that means, because I think most construction people out there listening might hear the end of RFIs and might have a little bit of a side eye as they try to understand, you know, what we actually mean by that statement. So to kind of get us started today, can you level set for me and define what a typical RFI process looks like and the impacts this approach really has on a project?
So the article that I wrote was intended to be provocative, but there was also an element of truth in terms of what we are trying to achieve. And requests for information, typically this stems from misinformation, lack of clarity, which typically tends to happen on the job site. And when an RFI gets issued, it's usually by people that are actually doing the work. And it's very much, again, with the contractual structures we have, before any work is put in place, you want to make sure that you're not held liable for something. So the best way you do it is you issue the RFI, and then you immediately do that, because obviously every time you're wasting not doing work is money spent. And so it typically takes about, I would say, almost 10 days to get a response from the RFI by the general contractor. In some cases, if it doesn't come from the general contractor, then the subcontractors or the trade contractors will then issue that directly to the architect or the owner's representative, whatever the contracting structure looks like. And then from there, you know, the process begins in terms of clarifying the questions that have been asked. You know, I think for us, it is, I would say, as part of the construction process, a necessary evil. Unfortunately,
I don't think I've ever heard anybody talk about the RFI process with very much enthusiasm, or, you know, it's not something that people look forward to. But like you said, with our current models and processes, it's just going to keep happening. But I'd love if you could share a little bit more about, like, why are these happening in the first place? And what kind of problems does that introduce into the construction process?
Yeah, so I think this goes back to just, at the highest level, it's disconnected information. You know, we talk about construction being highly collaborative, but then at the end of the day, people are all operating within their silos, within their particular systems, their technologies that they're using. And more often than not, those systems don't talk to one another. And so whether it is working off of outdated drawings out in the field, that can generate an RFI. There may be a mismatch and you're about to put something in the ground and you see there's something else in the place of that, that generates it. So what RFIs end up doing is they then lead to potential change orders, which then turn into change orders, which ultimately impacts your budget and your schedule. So RFIs are a precursor to something bad that potentially might end up happening. So the goal here is to really minimize those RFIs. And, you know, just to give you some context, for every $1 million worth of construction put in place, there are about 10 RFIs that get issued. And this is based on some studies that were done looking at projects from $5 million all the way to $5 billion. And if you just think about a typical large-scale project, that can run into almost $1 million in terms of processing fees associated with RFIs. So there are tangible impacts to construction companies that are already operating on very slim profit margins.
Yep, not even to mention the wasted time and energy just spent working on the RFI itself. So, like, you have these change orders that come out of it. But I mean, I worked at enough general contractors in my day to understand that time is precious, and having to spend so much time on these very manual processes is a challenge at the very base level for a construction company.
100%, Eric. And I'll just add one other thing. The reason why I think it is so apt now that we as an industry relook at this is, as what you just said, a lot of wasted effort. And as everyone knows, the labor shortages are not going away. So every minute, hour, day spent on processing, responding to RFIs is time taken away from actually building and trying to drive efficiency. So I think this is going to become more and more critical. How do we eliminate or reduce the proliferation of RFIs?
We have this great opportunity right now to be more impactful about how technology can introduce more automation at scale compared to where we've been even, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago. And I think a lot of people, when they hear automation, are sometimes hesitant or concerned because there's always a fear of this might take my job. And I always reiterate to people that automation and AI and other technology and construction, this is more of an augmentation conversation to, one, to fill that labor gap that you were talking about a minute ago, but also to let people focus on what they do well and let technology do at a scale what a human simply can't do. And so it's more of a matter of, I think our jobs are going to change in how we interact with the technology. It's not a job eliminator, it's a job shifter. But you'd mentioned in past conversations, automating waste and your concern about that. And I was hoping you could tell me a little bit more about the difference between what you mean with automating waste, especially in the case of RFIs, compared to automating a process that isn't wasteful just by its very nature.
Sure. So I have this term then, and I've spoken about this to other folks at general contractors as well as specialty contractors to gauge how they reacted to this. And I've actually received a good amount of endorsement around the way I've been thinking about this, which is there is one aspect of it, which is automating wasteful processes. That is something that we do not want to be in the business of doing. What we want to do is to eliminate waste. So the question becomes, what does automating waste mean? You can create the most perfect, elegant project management system that ensures collaboration between the trade contractors and the general contractors. But still, the fundamental problem of RFIs doesn't go away. All you've done is you've figured out a better way to move documents between different parties. That, to me, is not really solving the issue at hand. How do you actually eliminate the incidence of RFIs on the job site? That, to me, is the elimination aspect. So the more RFIs exist, there is more rework, there's more wasted work that gets done, right? So our approach is, how can we solve for that? How can we eliminate the incidence of RFIs? And we're fine eliminating the incidence of RFIs in the field, as long as we can also push those up into the planning phase. I think if you can do it there, you can start removing a lot of the wasted effort that happens downstream, which has cost and schedule implications. So for us, it's changing fundamentally the way we build. And I think part of that starts really upstream in design and planning.
It's a bold statement, I will have to say, but as you unpack the logic behind it, I really appreciate it because we're really taking a close look at what is a defective process, essentially. There, the system in the workflows that we're employing right now trend toward creating a considerable volume of RFIs, as you alluded to with some of those stats. And so if we're really truly looking to improve the industry, and like you said, not just automate a process to speed that process up, that's a bigger conversation, but it's one that I'm starting to hear more people have. And it's also, it's a conversation that kind of steps beyond Autodesk or any individual general contractor too. I had a very wonderful conversation with John Fish and Jim Lynch from a few months back when I was in Boston. And John really talked very bullishly about how these bigger industry problems are not ones for each of us to solve. And so I think it's a chance for us to be a lot more collaborative and rethinking, you know, just how do we approach building? And sometimes that doesn't feel great because people look at our normal model and they feel safe in that environment. But there's a lot to unpack there. And I think that automation conversation, if we're having it in the right way, is going to have a big impact.
I couldn't agree more, Eric. I think I'll also say that, you know, you think about the project delivery methods. Typically, the typical project delivery method was design, bid, build. We're seeing a lot more collaboration upstream. So with more like design, build, design assist, and then obviously everyone talks about the holy grail of integrated project delivery. Part of this is being driven also by the fact that, you know, we've got these challenges, whether it's labor shortages, material price increases that have caused extreme amount of volatility, which is really putting a premium of building it right the first time, right? And you can only do that if you're all coming together and collaborating. So I completely agree with you. This is not something that Autodesk can solve in isolation. I think this is where the industry needs to come together. GCs need to come together with specialties as well as owners. And I think if these three constituents come together, and part of that is also going to be revisiting the risk-sharing paradigm. Today, if everyone is protecting their side, we're never going to get the types of results we want. And I think there has to be an equitable risk-sharing model that comes into place. Now, you can say that's wishful thinking, but if you really want to make some improvement, this is how you're going to have to go and start to think radically differently.
I really like that take. And it's a culture conversation at one level. And it's also kind of a relationships conversation too. So the companies that are comfortable embracing that holy grail of IPD, like you said, they have a baseline of trust with all of those parties, I think, to even be comfortable stepping into that. And so it's kind of a matter of how do we set everybody up to share those risks in, like you said, a more equitable way so we're not being punitive to our partners on a construction project. And I'm empathetic of our existing model in the sense of people need to protect themselves. And that goes without saying, but there's a way to do it that serves the interest, I think, of the owner and the broader project, but also the end user, the people who are in those facilities and getting them built quickly and, you know, more safely and everything. So there's a whole bunch there. I'm going to have you back on another conversation. We talk more about delivery methods because I think that one's starting to become more and more prevalent in how people are taking an honest look at turning that, you know, a little bit upside down from that traditional design bid build model that we've been in for many years.
Could not agree more. And so I think we feel these events, there has to be some sort of catalyst to drive it. We talked about digitization, I think, at one of our earlier, you know, one of your earlier podcasts where I had the good fortune of being there. I would say the pandemic was a great driver on accelerating digitization. I think there are some residual impacts which are going to really force the industry to look at how they're building. I think it'll be fundamentally different 5 years out. The role of the GC is going to get redefined. You're going to see a lot more, I would say, mergers and acquisitions happening as people look to vertically integrate their supply chains. There's going to be a lot that's going to happen there. And I think I would expect owners to play a more prominent role in getting involved in the outcomes of the projects, because as we all know, the buck stops with them, and doing that right the first time is so critical to them, because every dollar and time spent idle is a cost that they need to incur.
And I love the move towards more progressive owners that we're starting to see as well. And as a former proposal manager, I've seen many RFPs that just make me quietly sigh and scroll through the email that I've received, especially when I was, you know, still working for federal contractors versus commercial. But the owners have a real opportunity to implement more thoughtful guidance and what their expectations are, but also lean on the general contractors who have the knowledge about bringing these new technologies and these new building methodologies to the table and having, a more honest 360 conversation at the onset of the project. Because if you're just copying, pasting sections from an RFP into a new one for years and years, you're not necessarily setting up things from day one in a way that's going to give you the best of the best. And so I also really like how the relationship between these contractors and the owners is starting to continue past handover and turnover, especially when you start thinking through digital twin technology, because oftentimes the GC is the one that has the knowledge to maintain that digital twin beyond handover. And so there's new revenue models that you can explore if you're a contractor, but also just an opportunity to keep that relationship going. And especially in the realm of, you know, serial builders who are out there, you know, building facilities over and over again as an owner, it's just a huge opportunity to really strengthen that relationship. But let's step back to our automation and waste conversation for a second. So what other steps should we be considering that go beyond slapping those band-aids on wasteful processes and stopping automating, you know, a wasteful process and fixing the root of these problems and automating the right things? Like where should people start when they're thinking through this?
I would say, again, it starts in integrated design and pre-construction, right? I think those are very much intertwined. I'll give you an example. I mean, a $100 million project as an example. It takes about 30 months in that design pre-con phase and takes 18 months on site building. If you even look at just the sheer amount of venture capital that goes in today into construction tech, I would argue that the vast majority is addressing challenges out in the field. It's not going really into the planning pre-construction phase. And I think that is, and I understand why venture capitalists and others are investing. They're going where the eyeballs are, where the highest level of monthly active users or weekly active users or daily active users are. I understand that. But you make or break your profit margins in pre-construction. You can really do a lot more in that. You can de-risk potential safety incidents if you're actually simulating the process. You can really identify issues before they actually happen if you're, again, going through the digital rehearsal process in pre-con. You can actually identify, as I said, all the RFIs that may potentially exist. So, and then when we talk about, you know, artificial intelligence and machine learning, I mean, that's a whole different aspect of it because construction generates a heck of a lot of information. So why do you need to make the same mistakes? Why do you need to ask the same questions every single time when you're out on the job site? Can't you ask those questions of the architects, of the engineers in pre-con, right? And you should be able to look at that in your software. This is where companies like Autodesk can really help the industry. It's we have information. And how can we create, leverage that to better serve the industry so that the next time you're working on a particular hospital project within a certain set of criteria and parameters, we are actually, the AI is basically flagging to the VDC manager, if you will, these are the things you need to look for. This can be a big coordination problem down the road. So I think there's a lot that we can do in terms of automating in the pre-construction phase that will have really significant impacts, beneficial impacts downstream.
And I think we're laying the groundwork right now in this broader digitization conversation. And I can see, like you said, the VCs are field first because that's the more obvious ROI for them. But the benefit of that is the rich amount of data that we have. And we did a research report, and many of you out there have probably heard me talk about this before, harnessing the data advantage in construction with FMI. And we dug a bit deeper into data strategies and why some people have them and why some don't. And it really made it very clear that having a data strategy is kind of a core element of being a competitive business. But this does connect back into that, I guess, ideal vision you were talking about earlier in this really meaningful scenario of connected construction, because our subcontractors and our general contractors and everybody who touches a project have really valuable feedback to offer to the pre-construction phase, but we often don't give them the opportunity to do that. And so it maps right back to what we started this conversation on, is you've got your designs and your plans, and there's something in there that isn't actually buildable in the way that it's been presented. And now your specialty contractor, your steel fabricator has to come back and say, hey, RFI, this doesn't make sense. And now you've started that 10-day clock and you've brought your change order in and you've shifted your schedule and you've shrunk your profit margin just a smidge. But in that ideal state that you're talking about, when you bring that conversation to pre-construction before things have, you know, been stamped and sent out to be built, you have a very different conversation in your hands, I think.
Absolutely. And I feel really excited because there is so much opportunity to drive greater efficiency in the entire process. You know, sometimes where you struggle is we're already a very optimized business. We've squeezed out all the margin we can possibly get. Everything else is really incremental. I think there's so much right now across the entire continuum, and we've talked about GCs, we've talked about design firms. Specialties have their own set of things, right? You talked about fabrication. That has a lot of inefficiencies baked in there that they're having to replicate models and rebuild them all the time for fabrication. There's a lot that can be done, and I feel we as a company, and you know, I'd say Autodesk, because I think, and saying this with all humility, the ability to connect design all the way to construction into operations. There aren't many companies that can do that. I think we are very well positioned to thread that digital, we'll call it that digital thread of data that we can actually deliver on. It's really up to us and to work very closely with our general contractor customers, with our specialty customers, with our owner customers to deliver on that vision. As you said, right at the onset of it, we can't do this alone. We have to do it with others. But there is light there at the end of the tunnel, which is really exciting.
And it's an exciting moment, too, because as the data standards start getting employed at these organizations and they start this really meaningful digital journey where their data is not siloed anymore, whether it's siloed in tool from tool to tool or if it's siloed from project to project, now you get to have that chance to step back and say, okay, I have project level insights, but I also have organizational level insights. And I really liked when you mentioned a moment ago, you're asking these same questions over and over and over again. And that's simply because people don't have the data to necessarily identify that that question might've been asked before. And so you have a chance to say, when I work with this subcontractor every time, now we're in a situation where this happens every time, but you can see that now. You can identify, you can have that conversation. And so I really appreciate that, but also just giving our field teams the actionable data in the moment that they haven't necessarily had as well. One of the other things we uncovered in that data strategy report was simply people are shooting from the hip as far as making decisions in the field because they often don't feel that they have real-time data to make decisions with, or they haven't trusted it historically because their data strategy wasn't impactful enough to have consistent quality data. And so there's so many layers that we can start adding into that conversation when we have a meaningful digital journey and we have data that people can trust to make decisions at, both in the field and then back in the office, just looking at the whole organization at large.
Absolutely. Could not agree more with you, Eric.
Let's talk a little bit more about your thoughts tied to this bespoke one-off project conversation. I think we were alluding to it a little bit earlier. And I've heard you talk about implementing manufacturing methods like prefab and modular construction out in our industry in a more meaningful way. And I feel like the last few years with all the craziness that's been going on, we've had a very meaningful push towards more diverse in modular, prefab, and things along those lines. How can these be leveraged more effectively to reduce our process waste in our projects out there?
Yeah, so first of all, you know, there's something really interesting happening just generally in the prefab space. So I think, you know, especially the NEPs, I should say, have been tabbing for quite some time. But again, prefabrication comes with a cost because you've got to set up your factory, your facilities, your fabrication shops. Not everyone can do it. You know, the smaller guys, it struggles. It's a big capital expenditure that's involved. The typical approach used to be you'd have your manufacturers who would sell to distributors or suppliers who would then sell to the, and I'm just using MEPs as an example, who would then fabricate. What's happening now is manufacturers are fabbing for MEP contractors, suppliers are fabricating for MEPs, and MEP contractors are fabbing for other MEPs because there's a lot of work that's happening. If you just look at the MEP landscape as an example, right? There's a lot of components that are going in, whether it is manufacturing facilities that are being stood up, whether it's data centers that are coming up, whether it's automotive plants with electric vehicles or battery manufacturing facilities, there's a lot for them. So I think MEPs are going to be busy for the next, I would say, almost decade. There's just a ton of work going there. So as a result, their factories are running full. And so some of the larger guys are fabbing for them. So what it's doing is it's kind of leveled the playing field around who can enter and do prefabrication. And I think that is really an interesting approach that's happening. Now, we know with prefabrication, and studies have shown that it definitely reduces schedule. It reduces the time to construct. Where the jury is still a little bit out is around the cost benefit. And some of the reasons for that is you may prefabricate something in a very controlled environment, but then you need to transfer that to the job site. And that involves logistics costs to move it to the job site. And then you need to make sure that the people that are actually going to install those components are following exactly the instructions that they need to follow. So if there is a disconnect between the field and the fab shops, that again can take away some of the benefits you would get, right? So I think we're on, some of the bigger MEP contractors have kind of nailed this. But if I were to look at it broadly as an industry and say, hey, is prefabrication guaranteed to give you cost saving? I would say we will get there. I'm not entirely certain yet that we can actually point to it and say, yes, there's a tangible ROI. If you did it, the results will come. There's still a lot of process to follow, but there's clearly a silver lining there, and it can really eliminate a lot of the waste, the material waste, because now you're doing it in a control setting versus out there, and you can really reduce a lot of mistakes that you're making. So I think prefabrication is the way to go. We're also seeing a lot of general contractors starting to self-perform more and set up more of their own facilities. And again, part of this is they want to take more control on their supply chains. With labor shortages and skilled workers at a premium, I was looking at an article recently which showed between now and the next 5 years, over 33% of all skilled workers are going to retire in North America. We're not adding enough people at the rate at which we're losing them. So I think something's got to give.
Yeah, we're at such an interesting moment. And I've been hearing the same thing as far as the increase in self-perform work. And it makes a bunch of sense. And especially in an environment where competing for talent is at its like highest level ever, especially for the most skilled people that we work and employ on our project sites, the certainty that you are a full-time employee for the general contractor and they are going to bring you from project to project, in contrast to project ends, you're immediately laid off now until there's a new project to bid. Like, there's a relationship that these employees are building with their teams in a way that I think has meaning. But as you alluded to also, that chaotic supply chain that we've been dealing with, any level of control that we can add back to the process as a general contractor or a specialty contractor, it makes a whole bunch of sense if you can set those systems up properly. But I also think that the prefab conversation, you also hit the nail on the head there. The coordination between the facilities you're creating and the project site, if it's not spot on, that's where the introduction of risk really comes in. And it's always where I hear the field teams get a little grumpy too. They go, oh, this has been built in some factory and they never talked to us. And if you have that level of skepticism out on your field team by default when you start, it's going to be harder to deploy this tool in the way that's going to have meaning. And so there's a bigger conversation, I think, that you need to be having with your organizations to ensure that they see the value that you're trying to offer and then also understand the processes you're implementing. I think it's something you try on a smaller scale and then you broaden, but it's also a delicate dance, as you alluded to, because you have to build that facility to do this properly. And not everybody has the resources or the lay down area to create a space like that. And so, you know, here we go.
But I do believe, I think with this leveling of the playing field, I think this is a trend to watch. I think more and more people will end up doing that. If I look at venture capital and where some of the money is being invested, I would also say a lot is going into modular and prefab. I think, you know, VCs are looking at that as definitely an interesting way to play the labor shortage over time, and a trend that is definitely picking up steam.
Yeah, and I definitely appreciate the impact that it has on the safety side as well, because any moment you can really step into that controlled environment and reduce the amount of people you have out on site, it's a win for, you know, everybody on the project. And we had this weird moment in the last few years with the state of everything where we suddenly had to have less people on site as we figured out how to navigate, you know, all the restrictions and challenges and such. And I think that silver lining is showing up today and kind of accelerating our embracing of some of these different tools and technologies, you know. So a small win coming out of that broader challenge we've all kind of been navigating, and it's not over by any stretch, but I think we're in a good spot. The industry is far more digitized than it was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. And, you know, I'm thankful for that at the very least.
Yeah. And I'll just add one other thing there, Eric, when we talk about, you know, when we talked about RFIs and eliminating waste, you know, we'd use RFIs as an anchor to when I wrote that article. But, you know, if I just think about waste can be various types. It can be material waste. It can be wasted effort and hours spent. And so, you know, one of the things that, as we think about it is, and we're seeing more and more robotics as an instance, right? You have labor shortages, so you're going to have more automation happening on the job site, whether it is using a robot to do drywall finishes or, you know, for laying, you know, doing layouts. That's one aspect of it. We've talked about prefabrication, you know, you're automating production in a much more holistic manner. And then the third piece I would call is, you know, workflow automation. And those can be things like, again, you can sit there as an estimator counting symbols, or you can actually automate symbol detection and boundary detection. Or I'll use an example of, you know, creating submittal registers. You can actually input it in Excel, or you can upload a specification manual into a system and have that created in a very short period of time with a very, very high degree of accuracy. So I think for us, there's various angles to come at this in terms of eliminating waste. And I think automation will be very important. I also think, how do you enable that everyone is reading from the same book? I think that digital thread, and I think part of it comes down to the common data environment. You know, I think we will probably see a bigger move. And we mentioned this when I was with Jim on your last, when I was there with you, I don't know, it was a couple of years ago. The industry is looking towards moving towards platform versus point solution. And I think it's fine to still use point solutions, but those platforms need to be open and integrated, right? And I think where the industry is going to move is work with those platforms that are open, that are integrated, so that the data can not only come into that platform, but then also can leave. Because as long as you have accessibility and interoperability, you have more better visibility of that data from which then you can run the analytics and get the insights. So all of that is towards that end of, you know, towards the better good of eliminating those RFIs in the field. So it's just not, as I said, pre-con is one piece, it's a very critical piece, but there are also a lot of other building blocks that go along in actually making that bold statement a reality.
Yeah, there's so much that goes into it when we're thinking about that waste elimination conversation. And we'll include a link to the article in our show notes, so everybody out there listening can take a closer look at everything that you had written and compare it to, you know, how we've unpacked it at a different scale here today. But I'm excited about where we're at in construction. And as the field kind of narrows in that overwhelming number of point solutions and starting to kind of shape up into something a little more manageable, and the platforms that really stand out start to become kind of industry standard, I think that conversation changes. And I empathize with our technology managers and our CIOs and CTOs and everybody out there in the industry, because our VC friends obviously had a very exciting moment when they realized, ooh, construction hasn't been digitized. Let's go get it done. And they have to a significant degree, but it's created so many different tools. It's very overwhelming for people to step back and go, how do I build out my tech stack to be most effective and not burdensome to my field teams and my office teams? And as you alluded to, I very firmly think that the picking the right platform that you center the rest of your technology decisions on is kind of step one in ensuring that you have this successful and open data environment where nobody's manually writing documents or moving documents around. Nobody's copying from a spreadsheet into a system that doesn't map one-to-one, because that's where your errors show up, because people are people. And so as soon as you can start automating that and make that data move around in a seamless way, that's not just hand-waving and actually meaningful, I think we're in such a better position than we have been in many years. So I'm excited. Like, it's still a little bit overwhelming, I think, for people at times, because there's a lot of choices to be made. But as soon as you kind of center on the right ones, your organizations are in a really great spot.
I agree, Eric. And look, I mean, I've been at Autodesk now over nine years, and I'll tell you, this is the most excited I've been. We are in a pivotal moment for our industry. I think as a company, I couldn't be more excited about our prospects and, you know, with Autodesk Construction Cloud. And so it's a culmination of a lot of hard work that the teams have done at Autodesk. And, you know, part of it is listening to customers and hearing from them and trying to fix their problems. And it's that aspect of it is great. And, you know, I've had the great privilege of actually talking to customers who have challenged me, who've challenged our organization to do better. And we love taking on that challenge because we understand the pain points that they feel. And unless you get on a job site and you see what those project engineers, those project managers, the superintendents have to do day in and day out, we need to make their lives easier. And so I think as a technology partner, there's a huge responsibility on us, and we don't take that lightly.
I'd agree with you completely. I think it becomes very obvious very quickly when trying and demoing technology that has been made for an industry to solve a problem that that industry doesn't necessarily have. And so you have a disconnect from the people who you want to use the thing you've created without actually listening to how they actually work and the problems and challenges they have. So the disruption conversation can happen all the time, but it needs to be in a deliberate way. Otherwise, you've built a tool that nobody wants.
Exactly. And Eric, I would say you always build for the end user, not the buyer.
Absolutely.
You have to. And more often than not, you'll be surprised how many times people forget that. It's like we sell it, we make it for the buyer, not the end user. And I think if you can keep consistently delivering on that, you know, as a company, a technology company, that's half the battle won.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely, Sid. So I've got two final questions for you today, and these are ones you're familiar with, I'm sure. First is our recurring question that I asked every guest, and I can't remember what your answer was last time. I should have went back and looked, but what is one tool that you will always bring to every project that you work on, no matter what project that is?
You know, I won't change from what I said the last time, because in fact, I've doubled down even more on it, and that's empathy. I think, you know, you talk to customers, you have to, whether it's your employees, whether it's your teammates, that is something that is so critical. We just get caught up in the minutia. You've got to step back and really appreciate and be sensitive and understanding of other people's challenges, problems, and really work with that, you know? And I think that's critical. And you know, when I spend time talking to customers, you can actually relate to the challenges that they go through. And, you know, that forces, that motivates me, that motivates my team to do better. And I think unless you can actually feel like you're in their shoes, I think having that ability, it's so critical for anybody. So I think that is something that will always remain in my toolkit.
And it's encouraging to hear people in leadership positions like yours say something like that too, because I think we've all had a manager or had leaders at organizations we've worked at in the past that the empathy part of business wasn't necessarily present. And I think that's a huge misstep because we are all people and we're all humans and we're all, everybody has something they're dealing with. And when you can step into an empathetic moment, and if it's a business conversation, really truly listen to the problem they've had. If it's something that's outside of business, it still impacts business. And so creating that environment to be transparent about what you're dealing with, but also just having the, you know, the ears to listen for that and manage all of your, you know, professional and personal situations with that empathetic ear, I think it goes a long way. So I love your answer. I appreciate the consistency. So if anybody out there wants to reach out to you and has any questions or, you know, wants to agree with your position on empathy and its importance in the business environment, where should they go?
Please find me on LinkedIn. Again, and if you listen to this and you don't necessarily agree with what I've said, my thoughts, I would welcome the opportunity to engage. You know, I do not at any point in time believe that what I'm saying is there's only one point of view. There are multiple points of view, and I'm always willing to hear. And I think that's the way we get better. And so if you'd like to engage with me on that, LinkedIn's a great way to establish that connection. I love spending time talking to customers. My team loves spending time. And, you know, whether it's customers or you are someone that's exploring Autodesk Construction Cloud or just wants to talk construction in general, feel free to reach out. We'd be more than happy to engage.
All right. Well, if you have any construction hot takes and you'd like to reach out to Sid, you can find him on LinkedIn. His full name will be in the show notes. And Sid, of course, thank you so much for joining me today. And everybody out there listening, I appreciate you joining us for another episode of Digital Builder. Of course, I am your host, Eric Thomas. You can find me out on LinkedIn as well or on Twitter at builder_digital. You're all probably tired of hearing me say this, but if you could take a couple minutes to go out and rate the show, throw us as many stars as you feel appropriate on whatever player you listen to. It actually does make a big impact for us on the business end. It bumps us up the rankings. And if you enjoyed the episode, please take a minute to share it with somebody else you might think would enjoy, you know, unpacking the wild world of RFIs. And on that final note, goodbye.